Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Renaissance English and Golden Age Spanish Drama, this week on Soundings. First, Graham Bradshaw of the University of St. Andrews discusses English Renaissance drama. Following that, John J. Allen of the University of Kentucky discusses the commercial playhouses of Golden Age Spain. According to Graham Bradshaw, a poetic dramatist or composer dramatist can present a seemingly inclusive and internally coherent world. This representation in turn becomes a metaphoric expression for the world that all of us inhabit. Here is Graham Bradshaw.
Well, I'm really trying to get back to some very basic questions about how poetic dramatists or composer dramatists characterize, how they characterize characters in the play or in the opera, and then at a more complicated level, how they characterize the particular world, the world of Wagner's Ring, or the Lear world, which isn't like the Macbeth world, and so on. Metaphor, it involves a fairly basic distinction, I think, a familiar one, between presentation and representation. If what I'm wanting to get at is a kind of transposition, a metaphor for the particular way of thinking. For example, in Lear's case, he's speaking verse, which is unnatural, not naturalistic. But then against that non-naturalistic base, we get very naturalistic details, like, pray you undo this button. Nothing more naturalistic than
something
that.
Which is very concrete and specific.
Yes, exactly. At one level, he's speaking grief more eloquently than, and heart-rendingly than anybody else might. My poor fool is hanged. No, no, no life. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all?
Right.
Then, when he goes on, thou'lt come no more, we don't get a line which goes, ta-tum, 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 ta-tum. That's what an iambic pentameter is doing. It's wrenched into the very opposite. Never, 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 never. Pray you undo this button. Thank you, sir, and so on. Now, what we're getting here is very complicated movements in and out of naturalistic and non-naturalistic modes. The thing that interests me about this is it's partly technical, but it's also, I think, in a much deeper sense, a vehicle for moral thinking, because what we do is we feel the emotion because it's so heart-rendingly expressed, but also the element of transposition, of metaphor, of presenting it through an aria like Rigoletto or through verse like Lear, allows us to chart it, to see the emotion, as it were.
How conscious is all of this on the part of the creators? Now, I take it, Graham Bradshaw, that you are not practicing psychobiography, that you are trying to, in effect, get into the minds of the composer or the writer. And yet you have to speculate about that to some degree, do you not?
You do, and I'm sure you know in asking it, it's a very complicated question.
What, for example, do you use for evidence? I mean, you have the text on the page.
Oh, yes.
I take it that you leave it at that. You're not looking necessarily at biographical elements about Shakespeare or about an operatic composer. You're working just with the evidence there in front of you. Am I being unfair to your documentation here?
No, and certainly what I'm concerned with is not intention of I'm concerned with the directing intelligence at work within the work. The rhythms of English fall into iambs. If I say the rhythms of English prose fall into iambs, I've just given you an example, I think. And sometimes it just happens. Now, notoriously, there are passages in Shakespeare where the prose starts to take on such an iambic rhythm that editors and scholars have gone on and on arguing about whether it's actually verse or prose. We get passages like that where we just can't tell, and that suggests that we shouldn't be too doctrinaire in talking about intention.
Well, after a fashion, if I follow you here, Graham Bradshaw, you're telling me that the way we inherit, and more particularly the way we interpret Shakespeare, for example, is always going to be a reflection of our own circumstances. Let's assume that's the case. What is it that you are bringing to your scholarship, your investigations into metaphorical worlds in opera and in Shakespeare, that might last beyond the next 25 years, beyond the next generation of scholars? Is that a judgment for you to
make?
That's
too flattering, but I'd want to take it back to the point I mentioned at the start, that I think that's what is going on when, say, in a Shakespeare play, or, say, in a Wagner or a Verdi opera, what is going on when we can both feel and, as it were, see or chart an emotion because it's being laid out for us in a non-realistic way? That's something which obviously you can discuss very technically, going into meter and prosody, and these things are necessary. But the importance, the true importance, seems to me that by working like that, the dramatist, be he a poetic dramatist or a composer dramatist, can be exploring our feelings, our states, can engage in a kind of thinking which seems to me, to use that word necessarily again, necessarily moral. So, to take up your question with Shakespeare, at least ever since Keats was talking about negative capability, it's been a large and precious part of our thinking about Shakespeare that one of the things that he does to an extraordinary degree is take us into a character and make us feel, even with an unsympathetic character or a character who's contemplating something atrocious like Shylock dropping his knife,
that to make it feel worthy.
What it is to be that character, what it is to feel like that and to be that. So there's this inward move. Now, Keats, in a way, I think, stops there. He's like little Jack Horner. He's always hauling out plums, but he never considers how the whole thing is put together. And once we start doing that and seeing how the particular kinds of verse, prose that characterize different characters belongs in the particular play, once we see how, as I'm suggesting, that we can indeed feel or chart and see the emotion altogether, then along with this inward, exploratory and sympathetic or empathetic movement, you also have something that is more detached, more diagnostic, so that we can feel with, say, a jealous Othello and with a jealous Leontes in The Winter's Tale, but at the same time we can see from the verse and what's happening in the verse that their emotions are quite different, that the word jealousy won't do for both of them, that they're thinking about their loved ones in utterly, utterly different ways.
Graham Bradshaw, let me get you to pause for just a moment. What about the audience? How does that enter into this?
Well, the distinction that I'm making between presenting in some quasi-naturalistic way and representing is a distinction with important consequences for the audience, because if what you're doing is observing a very, very naturalistic imitation, Dustin Hoffman being an autistic or whatever, only on stage, there's nothing in that kind of Moscow Arts Theatre for the audience to do other than feel it's looking in on something, like an eavesdropper. The actor can't afford to appear conscious of the audience, whereas in the other kind of theatre,
what you're doing here,
the audience is very involved, and of course you can have what people talk of as reflexive or metadramatic theatre, and a knowing audience in a no-drama or a Sanskrit play or a Racinian tragedy.
Just as a footnote to that, would you say, Graham Bradshaw, that that audiences, well, for example, with Shakespeare, were more sophisticated than audiences today?
I'm against thinking of the Elizabethan audience as any kind of monolithic entity. I'm sure that it was very variously composed.
Just as audiences today.
Yes, yes. But I think there were kinds of sophistication in Shakespeare's audience, or Racine's, and things that have become more alien to us. For example, I understand that in Racine's time, the actor or actress would never lift the arm above the shoulder.
What?
So
now,
you
why,
could convey
why,
an...
Why would that
be? Considered improper.
I see.
Indecent.
Uh-huh.
But if it's Phaedra lifting an arm almost to her shoulder, working with that convention, then what kind of intensity you can convey in that way?
Graham Bradshaw, let's conclude our conversation. Give me a specific example here that illustrates what you're after when you talk about the necessary metaphorical worlds. You referred earlier to what? The feeling of jealousy, that particular state as Shakespeare represents it. What have you got in mind?
Well, for example, taking Othello and Leontes, the difference of the states between them. Take that great speech in Act 4 uh-huh. of Othello. Had it pleased heaven to try me with affliction, had they rained all kinds of sores and shames on my bare head, and so on. Now through that speech, Othello is speaking with a quite remarkable control that's syntactic and logical. Right up to the end, he's trying to identify the worst grief, the thing that he can't bear, and he moves through the different things until he comes to, and note the image, but there, where I have garnered up my heart, where either I must live or bear no life, the fountain from the which my current runs or else dried up, to be discarded thence. At that point, where he's identified what he can't bear, the speech goes haywire, even, again, logically and syntactically. Huh. He becomes incoherent, or else dries up, to be discarded thence, or keep it as a cistern for foul toads to knot and gender in. Turn thy complexion there, patience. What's going on? Who's he talking to? And before we've had this wonderful syntactic charting, uh-huh. had it pleased heaven, I should have found, but alas, to make me, and yet could I bear that too. Now, Othello's way of thinking about Desdemona there is very interesting because he's thinking first of garnering up his whole heart in that, like a storehouse, is the image, and then she becomes the fountain, the source of the value of his life. What could be more different than Leontes' kind of jealousy?
Tell me about that.
Well, there he's... All of his images for his wife show that his way of thinking about her is an extension of his property, of his estate. And at the same time, the verse is moving in such an extraordinarily free, though controlled way, that it's giving us a measure of a diseased, a sick, compulsive, obsessive mind. You notice in his case, again, if you look at the sort of large, logical, syntactic shape of the speech, that he can't bring it to a conclusion. He can't keep his mind on the trajectory that he's trying to assign to the lines. So we get this kind of thing in the famous speech where he's actually got his little boy present. Inch thick, knee deep, or hidden ears, a forked one, go play, boy, play. It goes on like that for a while. Let me get this. And many a man there is, even at this present, now while I speak this, holds his wife by the arm that little thinks she has been sluiced in his absence, and his pond fished by his next neighbour, by Sir Smile, his neighbour. Nay, there's comfort in it, whilst other men have gates, and those gates opened as mine against their will, should all despair, so he can't stop. And 'tis powerful, think it. From east, west, north, and south, be it concluded, no barricado for a belly. Be it concluded, but he still can't conclude. The word belly releases further. Horrible images in his mind, so we yet know it. It will let in and out the enemy with bag and baggage. Many thousand honours have the disease and feel it not. How now, boy? Disease indeed.
Graham Bradshaw teaches at the University of St. Andrews. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During his fellowship year at the center, Graham Bradshaw worked on a study of poetic drama and music drama as metaphor. Soundings on Renaissance European drama continues. My guest now is John J. Allen of the University of Kentucky. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, John J. Allen worked on a study of commercial playhouses in Golden Age Spain. J. Allen, welcome to the National Humanities Center and to Soundings. I guess it's fair to say that a lot of people know about Shakespeare, Elizabethan drama, but there was something else going on dramatically in Europe at the same time. What was Golden Age Spanish theater all about?
Well, it turns out that it's about some of the very things that Elizabethan theater was about. It's exactly contemporaneous, and it's produced in very similar circumstances for a very similar type of audience. So I think there are many more similarities than differences. The biggest difference is that Spanish drama is not known very, very much outside Spain.
Why did that happen? I mean, you can't say that there was some sort of cultural conspiracy, or can you? What quashed it, so to speak?
Well, no, it's hard to talk in terms of conspiracy. At the time, of course, Spain was a leading power and was ruling great part of the earth. Subsequent fortunes of Spanish politics, I suppose, have something to do with it. But I think a major element in the situation being that Spanish drama does not travel well is the polymetric verse. There is so much varied tradition behind each kind of verse form. We're talking about verse drama. That when you translate it, there is no way to pick up all of those kinds of associations. And I think that's one of the difficulties. And it's one of the reasons that there are not many translations, and that even among those translations, there are not many good ones.
Name some names for me, J. Allen. What kinds of dramatists, who are you interested in, and why would these writers have taken on some fame or notoriety in their own time? And again, by extension, tell me why that fame or notoriety didn't pass itself along to us.
Well, we're talking in the initial stages of this particular kind of theater of Miguel de Cervantes, and everyone, of course, is overly familiar without having read it with Don Quixote. But Cervantes began his literary career by writing 20 or 30 plays for these new Madrid stages. The power in the early stages, the formative stages of the Comedia, was Lope de Vega. Lope de Vega is a man who, in addition to all kinds of other compositions in a very active life, wrote something like 400 comedias that we have left now.
All right, now locate him in time for me.
He's born in 1562, died in 1635.
Uh-huh. How widely known was Lope de Vega to Spanish? You call them theater goers? I mean, how do you characterize
him? Oh, he was known. He was a major figure in Spanish culture. The theater was, after all, one of the few communal forms of entertainment going then. He was operating in the capital, and everyone knew who Lope was. His name was part of the popular language. Uh-huh. Es de Lope. Es de Lope meant it's high quality, it's first rate.
What did he write about?
Everything under the sun, you can imagine. He said he wrote 1,500 plays.
We weren't
sure whether that figure is anywhere near accurate, but there are some 400 left. And they split up into every conceivable kind of dramatic genre, religious plays, history plays, cape and sword action, contemporary drama, all sorts of different kinds of drama, all so, three-act verse plays.
So these dramas would fill the place of what the newspapers, radio, television, cable, everything that we know today of, that we think of today in terms of popular culture.
Just about the center of popular culture. Anything else that such a restricted play was, recitals of one kind or another, must not have had an audience, anything like these.
Who went to these plays?
A very wide spectrum of society.
This wasn't just the cream of the crop, the aristocracy sort of stuff.
No. It was very like the situation in Elizabethan England, like that situation appears to be. There's some discussion about who actually made up the audience in London also. But it's clear that right down to what we would consider the bottom of urban society was able to go at least once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the boxes, many of the boxes which were not in the theater but in the neighboring houses, came under the power of pretty powerful nobles.
All right, now, J. Allen, you make your living as a professor of Spanish at the University of Kentucky. Who reads this stuff besides people like you and your colleagues? I mean, can you walk into a bookstore and find Lope de Vega? And if you can, why is it? If you can't, why is that?
You can find Lope de Vega in every bookstore in Spain, partly because it's studied in every school in Spain, and it's always been studied. The new element, I suppose, now is that it's being thought more of a performance genre rather than something that you only read.
And that brings us to your project.
Exactly. That's the focus. That's what some of us are trying to do now, is to recapture some of the original circumstances, not just staging, but the commercial circumstances, the social circumstances, so that we can understand these plays a little bit better and not think of them as some kind of archaeological material.
All right. Well, now, be specific for me, J. Allen. How does the performance of one of these plays enrich your understanding of what was going on the stage itself and then, as you say, the social circumstances surrounding the performance?
Well, in the past few years, when I've been trying to come to grips with the actual circumstances of production, I've become aware of a number of things. partly by reading other criticism, particularly a lot of it that has to do with Elizabethan theater. The fact that we're dealing not with a mimetic theater that tries to look like something, but in many cases it's emblematic. It's standing for something or pointing towards something. This requires really a different attitude.
All right, and the something spectrum. Here is what, politics or?
Could be political, uh-huh. But could be simply instead of attempting to replicate a scene, there are allusions to it, emblems of it, rather than a specific representation.
All right, now I'm still a little bit at sea here. Be very specific for me. What have you got in mind?
Well, one of the things that's very common in these plays is the use of the backdrop to a very shallow stage with curtains behind it on two or three, in Madrid, three levels, where a curtain can be opened and show a kind of tableau. This is not realistic theater at all, but there may be a wife being bled to death by her husband or a
nice.
Saint being martyred or something like that.
Oh, boy.
It's quite different from our sort of conventions. That's the main thing, is to try to get into the conventions behind these plays.
All right, and what kind of import would a convention such as the one you've just described have for a then-contemporary Spanish audience?
Well, I think that they were trying to do several things. One of their literary principles that's embodied in scenes that use these kind of effects is admiratio. They wanted to produce some kind of wonderment or awe in the audience.
Uh-huh.
They had a good deal of machinery, more than I think they did in London. And there's a kind of a special effects thing that we can understand if we think about our own contemporary theater now.
Uh-huh.
They were different, but they were special effects.
What about the moral dimension, so to speak? Was Lope de Vega attempting successfully or otherwise to instruct his audiences about this or that?
Well, this has been a major tenet of the criticism that all of the Commedia has an underlying moral purpose. A man named Alexander Parker focused on that, and it's been debated one way or another, but it's one of the basic starting points of thinking about Commedia content.
In what fashion, more? Are we talking about the teachings of the Catholic Church, or are we talking about the philosophical idiosyncrasies of the writers themselves? Tell me.
No,
about
they're
that.
more general propositions. Early in the Commedia, I think they're much more on the surface and simpler. Whereas by the time you get to a later playwright such as Calderón de la Barca, there are theological points being actually worked out on stage that are more complex than the issues usually gotten into earlier.
Did this, what, moral dimension sort of fall by the wayside? Is it, moral maybe is too strong, this instructive dimension. That's I take it, a constant through these plays.
Well, I think so. There is also a kind of an undercurrent in many plays of something being said about the government, about the way things are being run. There's a whole set of privado plays, they're called, which criticize the use of favorites, the power of favorites, and so on.
There's some,
what seems to be fairly daring criticism.
And sometimes. How did the state react to these plays of privilege, or what did you call them, privado?
Privados, yeah, the people who had special access and special power.
Did the state react negatively to that sort of thing?
There doesn't seem to have been a great fuss about this. There was always in the background the complaints of the moralists about the immorality of the theater and the immorality of the actors and actresses.
Same things that the English Puritans objected to. Do you think that this investigation that you are conducting into Golden Age Spanish drama, its reconstruction, its what pertinence to the present, is that going to make any difference in our notions of what the theater is and what social functions it serves, or are we going to go through a long, long filtering down process before this all sort of arrives at American shores?
Well, it'll have some impact right away, not necessarily in America. It'll certainly have an impact in Spain and Spanish America right away. And as far as the United States, the Chamisal Festival that's held in El Paso every year plays Golden Age plays for a week at a time, and they will be staged differently, probably. There will be an influence right away on Elizabethan studies.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be working with the people in the Globe Reconstruction Conference on issues in the Reconstruction that will help decide how to reconstruct the Globe that's being now done on Bankside in London. The only artifact that we had to work with at all for a while was the theater in Almagro, which was discovered in 1954, really uncovered, and it turned out to be virtually intact.
And it's taken more than 30 years to sort of get the ball rolling.
That's
there.
That's right. It's taken only recently I attempted to prove the authenticity and the antiquity of that particular model, and it's beginning to receive a little more attention than it did before. But now we're working on a theater in Alcalá de Henares. The city government is gathering critical opinion as to what the future should be of this theater, where there are remains of the foundations and some superstructure and a contract from 1601 for the building of this theater.
Mm-hmm.
This is the most important find and comparable with the Rose.
And who's working on this? Archaeologists, city engineers, literary critics? You got a whole mess of people working.
Well,
right?
It's a curious phenomenon from the beginning because it was discovered by three undergraduates who were not even theater specialists. They were aficionados who put on a lot of theater.
Yeah.
And in an abandoned movie theater, they discovered these foundations and the superstructure, and they doped out what it was. They went to the archives, to which they finally got access after years of trying. They finally allowed them to go in, and they found the contract. So then they interested some Hispanists in England and in the United States, and finally, I think a bunch of us were able to persuade the authorities to give them their head.
John J. Allen teaches at the University of Kentucky. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During his recent fellowship year at the center, John J. Allen worked on a study of commercial playhouses in Golden Age Spain. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 512. That's program number 512. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, two conversations about feminism and public policy. My guests will be Carol Cohn of Harvard University and Jane Flax of Howard University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, a German legend which dates back to the summer of the year 1376. According to tradition, when a piper hired to rid Hamelin of rats was refused payment, he led the town's children into a hole in a hill. This week commemorates the birth in 1844 of the Reverend William Archibald Spooner. His accidental transpositions gave us the word spoonerism. The Muslim New Year, 1411, commences this week. In the Islamic calendar, it's called the Era of the Hegira. The first airplane crossing of the English Channel occurred 81 years ago this week, and the world's first test tube baby was born during mid-July 1978. Birthdays this week include the novelist Aldous Huxley, the filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, the Puerto Rican patriot José Barbosa, the Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw, the American First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, the entertainer Rudy Vallee, and the desperado John Dillinger. Finally, this week marks an anniversary for the first presidential cabinet department. The United States Department of State was initially known as the Department of Foreign Affairs when it was established by Congress in mid-July 1789. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Stagecraft in the English Renaissance and in Golden Age Spain, this week on Soundings. Graham Bradshaw of the University of St. Andrews discusses poetic drama during the English Renaissance. John J. Allen of the University of Kentucky discusses the commercial playhouses of Golden Age Spain. Stagecraft and artistry in Renaissance Europe. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.